Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
More gunfire along the border with Rwanda and the DRC, and Uganda's controversial foreign minister is elected to head the UN body. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. Gunfire has erupted for a second day on the border between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reports from the area say soldiers exchanged fire briefly this morning in a town north of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province. Each side has accused the other of provoking the clashes. Meanwhile, the UN mission in Congo has called on all parties to reduce tension and avoid further violence. Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa defended his position on homosexuality and domestic corruption allegations shortly after he was tapped to be the next president of the UN General Assembly. The Assembly unanimously elected Kutesa on Wednesday. He is to serve in the high-profile position that includes presiding over meetings at the 193 Nation Assembly. Kutesa recently gained international attention for defending Uganda's harsh anti-homosexuality law. Reporters at the UN questioned him about both issues shortly after his election. However, he was congratulated by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said Kutesa brought a wide-ranging experience to the job. Sierra Leone has declared a state of emergency in a district where an outbreak of Ebola virus is spreading. The government announced the closure of schools, movie theaters, and nightclubs late on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the government has said Ebola has now claimed 16 lives in Sierra Leone. Several hundred Brazilian protesters are demonstrating across the country before the World Cup begins. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
A couple hundred people have gathered in downtown Rio 2 hours before the opening of the World Cup to protest social policies and expenditures, billions of dollars spent on stadiums. We have school teachers here. We have health workers. We have political activists. They feel that a great injustice was done and that the social services that Brazil needs are being neglected. As a result, they are pledging to demonstrate throughout the cup and say that really they wish there was no cup at all. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
You can read more on the World Cup at voanews.com. Islamist Sunni militants are threatening to advance on Iraq's capital after seizing several other key cities in a blow to the country's Shiite-led government. A spokesman for the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant said in a message posted today that the militants also want to take the city of Karbala. Meanwhile, earlier today, President Barack Obama spoke on the situation in Iraq and says the international community needs to help the country in dealing with these latest developments.
What we've seen over the last couple of days indicates the degree to which Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
You can read more on the latest developments in Iraq at voanews.com. A Pakistani court has ordered the government to lift a travel ban on former military ruler Pervez Musharraf. He faces charges of treason. The court today approved Mr. Musharraf's request to have his name removed from an exit control list. The court's order cannot be executed for 15 days, which gives the government time to appeal. Japan has summoned China's ambassador in Tokyo to protest an incident in which two Chinese fighter jets flew dangerously close to a pair of Japanese surveillance planes in the East China Sea. Tokyo's defense ministry says the Chinese jets came within 30 meters of the Japanese aircraft on Wednesday. National political leaders in India have slammed provincial government officials in Uttar Pradesh for a deterioration of security in the state amid new rape allegations. The criticism today comes on the heels of several heinous crimes in the province, including the May rape and murders of two teenage girls. Villagers found the bodies of the 12 and 14-year-old girls hanging from a tree. I'm Frances Alonzo in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihayis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
For centuries, the rape of women, girls, men and boys has been a feature of conflict and warfare. These crimes have been taking place on a vast scale without many people even being aware of it.
That's British Foreign Secretary William Hague speaking at the conference to end sexual violence and conflict. Details coming up.
Also in the news in Libya, an attack by a suicide bomber east of Benghazi wounds three soldiers and three civilians.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Libyan army officials say a suicide bomber attacked a military checkpoint of rogue army general Khalifa Haftar east of Benghazi. The approaching vehicle exploded, wounding three soldiers and three civilians. The driver of the car died in the attack. More than 100 people have died in Benghazi since the retired general mounted a full-scale attack on the camps of Islamist militias. Several militias have gained control of parts of Benghazi since the fall of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Haftar served as Gaddafi's military chief of staff.
Gunfire has erupted for a second day on the border between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reports from the area say soldiers exchanged fire briefly today in a town north of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province. Each side has accused the other of provoking the clashes. DRC officials say Rwandan forces crossed into northern Kivu yesterday, kidnapped and killed a Congolese soldier. Rwanda says Congolese forces crossed the border and opened fire. Congo says two of its soldiers were killed in Wednesday's fighting, while Rwanda puts the number of Congolese dead at five. The UN mission in Congo has called on all parties to reduce tensions and avoid further violence. The two countries have been at odds for years, with the DRC accusing Rwanda of backing Congolese rebel groups, including M23, which Congolese forces defeated last year. Kigali denies those accusations. It accuses Congo of harboring the FDLR militia, which includes fighters who took part in Rwanda's 1994 genocide.
Eight minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Security Council has condemned yesterday's car bombing attack in Mali, in which four Chadian peacekeepers died and four others were wounded. It happened in a remote area in the north. All victims were identified as members of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, or MINUSMA. There are unconfirmed reports that some Mali soldiers may be among the victims of the unknown attackers.
The Global Summit on Ending Sexual Violence in Conflict continued today in London. Thousands of ministers, activists, survivors, and others are calling for international action to prosecute those responsible and help those who've been victims. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The summit is the largest gathering of its kind. The cornerstone of the event is the release of the International Protocol on the Documentation and Investigation of Sexual Violence in Conflict. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says it aims to shatter the culture of impunity in sexual violence.
This impunity is a major factor in why these crimes continue. Up to 50,000 women were victims of sexual violence during the war in Bosnia, but only just over 60 people have ever been successfully prosecuted for it. From Central African Republic to Sudan to Syria, untold thousands of rapes have gone entirely unpunished.
He says one of the biggest reasons for the lack of prosecutions is the difficulty in gathering evidence that can stand up in court. He says the protocol will teach those on the front lines of conflict to document and investigate the attacks, including interviewing survivors and witnesses.
We believe the time has come to end the use of rape in war once and for all, and we believe it can be done. We're convinced this is an issue of international peace and security that is central to conflict prevention, that it is fundamental to the advancement of women's rights everywhere, and above all, that it is a moral issue for our generation.
Haig says sexual violence in conflict is an age-old problem.
For centuries, the rape of women, girls, men, and boys has been a feature of conflict and warfare. These crimes have been taking place on a vast scale without many people even being aware of it.
The co-host of the summit, actress Angelina Jolie, is a special representative for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR.
It is a myth that rape is an inevitable part of conflict. There is nothing inevitable about it. It is a weapon of war aimed at civilians. It has nothing to do with sex, everything to do with power. It is done to torture and humiliate innocent people, and often very young children.
Jolie says victims of sexual violence in conflict often have nowhere to turn for help.
I have met survivors from Afghanistan to Somalia, and they are just like us, with one crucial difference. We live in safe countries, with doctors we can go to when we're hurt, police we can turn to when we're wronged, and institutions that protect us. They live in refugee camps or bombed out streets in areas where there is no law, no protection, and not even the hope of justice. They struggle to keep their children safe, and if they admit to being raped, they are likely to face more violence and social rejection.
Nigerian Foreign Minister Aminu Wale is among the many ministers who addressed the summit. In April, hundreds of schoolgirls were kidnapped in northern Nigeria by the militant group Boko Haram.
The time has come for us to redouble our efforts in our fight against this scourge and hold perpetrators accountable.
He says it's imperative to include women in all aspects of mediation, post-conflict recovery, and peace building, and that victims of sexual violence in conflict receive reparations.
Sexual violence in conflict cannot be ended by countries acting alone in an isolated manner. It will require strategic coordination between countries.
Helen Clark, head of the UN Development Program, says both political will and action are needed to protect the vulnerable.
At UNDP, we believe that political commitments to end sexual violence and conflict just have to be accompanied by the investments needed in the systems and the capacities which will bring about real change. Initiatives in these areas must also form part of broader efforts to address the causes and consequences of violence and to promote gender equality and women's empowerment.
Clark says sexual violence outlives a conflict.
We know so well that war often does not end for women when a formal conflict stops. And that is why it is so important for women to be at the very center of building the peace. In Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, we've supported the authorities to investigate many, many hundreds of sexual and gender-based violence cases and transfer them to the formal judicial system.
Clark calls on governments to address the scourge of sexual violence, not only in conflict, but in societies which are supposedly at peace. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is wrapping up today in New York. Attending the meeting are representatives from around the world who have been exchanging ideas and promoting initiatives to improve the lives of the disabled. Activists say they are disproportionately represented among the world's most marginalized groups. The convention offered the opportunity for human rights activists to highlight the lives of people with disabilities. Yetna Bersh Negusi is the executive director of the Ethiopian Center for Disabilities and Development. The attorney, who is also blind, is attending this week's convention. She spoke with me about the challenges facing the disabled in Ethiopia.
People with disabilities living in Ethiopia are primarily poor. Mainly, attitude becomes the first challenge because there is high prevailing prejudice and myths about their disability. And due to socioeconomic development level of Ethiopia, most of the disabilities we have are preventable causes, such as trachoma, polio, and so on and so forth. But once you're disabled, it's very tough to get included in the community and to be able to contribute towards the development. That's mainly attitudinal, I would say. And of course, there are also physical and infrastructural issues such as inaccessibility of buildings, inaccessibility of services, including information and communication, transportation, happen to be among the prevailing leading challenges for people with disabilities in Ethiopia.
Of these challenges that you have listed, are there any areas that stand out as requiring immediate attention?
There is a need for crucial advocacy and awareness to be undertaken for the community at large. But there are obstacles that we cannot easily remove, such as having no capacity, as well as the civil society law, which prohibits organizations receiving funds from abroad not to do advocacy work or disability rights work. In Ethiopia, I'm not sure if you're aware that we have a new CSO law which was passed 3 years ago, and that law requires organizations receiving funds from abroad not to engage in disability rights and awareness raising. So that becomes an impediment not to take this issue forward.
Given this, then, how can people with disabilities be included in development of policies and programs that will help them and to help empower them to have a normal life?
Of course, there are some enabling laws, such as the labor proclamation that Ethiopia has passed in 2008, which talks about the merit-based employment for persons with disabilities. And also there is very important proclamation number 691, which clearly states that all the executive organs should include disability into their roles and responsibilities as executive organs. And also the parliament has come up with a checklist or a directive which makes executive organs accountable as to what they have done on disability. The problem is on the civil society side, given this restriction that civil societies have, the check and balance is highly manipulated. So the government is trying its best to put in place systems and policies which it thinks will promote the rights of persons with disabilities. But that's not enough, you know, given the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. There is a need for having a strong and vibrant voice of persons with disabilities in the country. And as I mentioned, given the weak nature and capacity that those disabled persons organizations have, they opt to receive foreign funding, and there are no strong service providers in the country. The disabled persons organizations focus on the service provision for their members other than advocacy.
As a person representing people with disabilities at the convention there in New York, what are your expectations from this convention?
I would still say that the seventh session of the convention, the cost is mainly focusing on information exchange, and also dealing again with the incorporation of disability or the CRPD into the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. So my wish to see in this is that Ethiopia clearly continues to implement the CRPD, as well as Ethiopia becomes a great role player in terms of bringing forward the issue of disability in the post-2015 development agenda.
That was Yetna Bersh Negusi, the executive director of the Ethiopian Center for Disabilities and Development. She spoke with me from New York. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. In Libya, an attack by a suicide bomber east of Benghazi wounds 3 soldiers and 3 civilians. And gunfire has erupted for a second day on the border between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The West Africa Commission on Drugs says the region needs a new approach to tackling drug-related crime. The commission, which released its findings today in Dakar after nearly 2 years of research, says countries should not criminalize drug use or militarize their approach to traffickers. VOA's Anne Look has more.
Over the past decade, West African countries have made headlines, seizing tons of narcotics at their coastlines and airports. Thousands of arrests have been made. While it looks impressive on paper, it's not enough. Most of those going to prison are addicts or small-time dealers, couriers, and middlemen. The trafficking and use of drugs like cocaine and heroin continue to climb. Labs producing amphetamine-type stimulants like meth have cropped up in the region. In addition, drug money can buy elections and destabilize governments. Organized crime and extremist groups are getting in on the action. Those are among the findings of the West Africa Commission on Drugs, created by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, a native of Ghana.
Current drug policies are not working. We must now have the courage to change policies that no longer fit the reality.
Nigeria's Drug Law Enforcement Agency says between 1990 and 2013, it seized 178 tons of cocaine. It sounds impressive, but ex-Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo put those numbers in perspective.
Just 1 ton of cocaine that reaches Europe via West Africa is worth more than the security budget of many of our countries.
Mr. Obasanjo led the commission during its investigation. He said all that trafficking has also meant more drug use in the region.
Our region is simply not ready or adequately equipped to deal with the spread of drug use and dependency. The response all too often is to stigmatize and penalize drug users. However, pushing them to the fringes of society or locking them up in ever-increasing numbers will not solve the problem.
The commission says countries should decriminalize taking drugs and the possession of small amounts of them for personal use. It says drug use should be treated as a public health problem, and the focus should be on things like opening treatment centers. That's a stark contrast to the so-called prohibitionist approach that has characterized the now decades-long war on drugs in the Americas. Some experts say that war has failed. The violence only intensified, and drugs did not become less available. The commission says West Africa has a chance to avoid those mistakes. Guatemala's Foreign Affairs Minister Fernando Carrara says the commission's recommendations for West Africa are in line with evolving thinking in his region.
The fact is that prohibition has failed. Regulation is the new word. We need to work on interdiction, but in a different way. Interdiction, as usual, is not enough, is not doing enough. We need to work on public health. We need to work on better social services. We need to work on economic opportunities for the poor.
He, like Mr. Obasanjo, says law enforcement should go after high-level targets, the so-called big fish. That takes political will and specialized coordinated units dealing with narcotics, money laundering, and corruption. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Two
mark the World Day Against Child Labor, which is today, the International Labor Organization reports progress is being made in reducing the number of children forced to work, but more needs to be done to eliminate the worst forms of child labor. Lisa Schlein reports from ILO headquarters in Geneva.
The International Labour Organization reports child labour has declined by one-third since 2000, down to 168 million in 2012. ILO child labour expert Furio Rosati says there is growing public awareness of the dangers and risks run by children forced to work. This is especially true for children involved in hazardous work, such as agriculture, mining, and domestic labor. He tells VOA more governments are implementing policies targeting child labor, and more efforts are being made to keep children in school and out of work. Rosati says this is being done by providing social protection, such as health insurance and unemployment insurance for poor families.
Social protection is a very important element, because one of the factors that pushes children into work is the vulnerability of the household, either the dire poverty or the exposure to negative shocks. So if someone in the household gets unemployed or is sick, cannot work anymore, then the children are, of course, exposed to the risk of becoming worker to support themselves and their households.
The ILO reports sub-Saharan Africa has the highest rate of child labor, with one out of five children forced to work. But the most child laborers are in the Asian and Pacific region. The agency says the greatest reduction in child labor is in Latin America and the Caribbean, where cash transfer programs for children and families are being implemented. It notes cash and in-kind child and family benefits, when combined with access to education and health services, are effective in combating child labor. Rosati says very few countries in Africa have social protection systems, but he says pilot programs involving cash transfers are going on in several countries, including Senegal, Burkina Faso, Zambia, Malawi, and Kenya. He says Ethiopia is operating a large public work program. He says South Africa's plan to cover the poor is having a good side effect on children.
They introduced a pension for all people, but there has been shown that by introducing this pension system that protected the vulnerable old people, the children benefited a lot and child labor was reduced substantially and school attendance increased a lot.
The ILO says momentum is building in the fight against child labor, but efforts need to be accelerated. Unfortunately, the ILO says its target date of 2016 for eradicating children in prostitution and pornography and other worst forms of child labor will be missed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Liberia-flagged oil tanker seized by pirates a week ago in the Gulf of Guinea has been found empty of its cargo. Managers of the Mount Fair Artemis say the captain and crew were returned unharmed. A statement offered no other information. The tanker last made contact on June 4th when the captain sent a distress signal that pirates were boarding the vessel off the coast of Ghana. Oil piracy has tripled in the Gulf of Guinea in the last year, with the theft of tankers, the kidnapping of crews, and the ransoming of officers on board.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Ihis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAFootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAFootball.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Libya, an attack by a suicide bomber east of Benghazi wounds three soldiers and three civilians. And the United Nations mission in Congo is investigating a cross-border clash between Rwanda and the DRC that left five Congolese soldiers dead. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC. And in our feature segment, criticism over the slow implementation of Zimbabwe's new constitution. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky.
That's We Are One, Olé Olé, the official song of the 2014 World Cup football tournament in Brazil. The soccer extravaganza officially kicks off later Thursday night. And joining us now to tell us more is VOA's Sunny Young. Sporty World Cup greetings, Sonny.
Sporty World Cup greetings to you, Kim. Very soon in Sao Paulo, football's greatest spectacle will officially kick off. Brazil will host Croatia in the opening match of the 32-nation football jamboree. But before the Brazilian and Croatian players step onto the pitch, American entertainers Pitbull and Jennifer Lopez and Brazilian songstress Claudia Leite will sing We Are One, Olé Olé, the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup. Let's get into that World Cup spirit, VOA football fans. Put your flags up in the sky.
Put your flags up in the sky. Feel. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we invite the whole world to play. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we invite the whole world to play. En mi mundo, tu mundo, el mundo de nosotros. Invitamos a todo el mundo a jugar con nosotros.
One knife rocks the world, unite two sides, one fight and a million eyes. Four hearts gonna work so hard.
We are one, ole ole, the official song of the 2014 World Cup. Well, our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot Adeyemi, will be giving us World Cup updates during his Nightline Africa Sports on Sundays at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Segun has written a World Cup feature, and it's getting international distribution. Segun's article is titled, "Will Africa Break the Quarterfinal Jinx?" And he addresses the question of whether an African team will get past the quarterfinal stage for the first time in Brazil. Only three African teams have ever reached the World Cup quarterfinals: the indomitable Lions of Cameroon at Italy 1990, the Lions of Teranga from Senegal at Japan, South Korea 2002, and the Black Stars of Ghana at South Africa 2010. The Black Stars kick off their World Cup campaign Monday when they play the United States in Natal, Brazil. At a news conference in Sao Paulo, where the American team is based, the USA's German coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, said his squad is looking forward to the match.
Now it's almost a month of preparation. Obviously, the team is eager to get this thing started. You know, we can't wait to play our first game on Monday against Ghana. And you can just sense, and I don't know how it is with you, but I think you can sense now the excitement of the population here, of the people here. They want to embrace it. It's their World Cup. It's their big, big, big stage now that Brazil will show the world. And we are just proud to be part of it. But at the same time, we're very ambitious and hungry. And we want to get it started on the right foot against Ghana in a few days from now.
The USA's World Cup coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, is well aware that Ghana has eliminated the American team from the past two World Cups, Germany 2006 and South Africa 2010. He's also well aware that along with European powers, Germany and Portugal, the USA has been placed in what's widely regarded as the group of death.
You know, this is probably the most difficult group, you know, in the World Cup, you know, and we can't wait to get it started. You know, we respect every opponent, every player that we face in those three group stage games. And we know about their strengths, but we also know about their weaknesses. And now we know about our strengths, and we know about, you know, what we need to improve still. So we're working on that since a month, you know, with a tremendous group, you know, with a tremendous energy that we have. And over the last two and a half weeks, we built more and more the chemistry. You know, we automized a lot of things in training. So we feel very confident to go into this game against Ghana. But we also know, you know, what Ghana represents as one of the top nations in Africa. There's no doubt about it. And what Portugal and Germany represents. But we are eager to challenge them now. We are eager to go eye to eye with them now. And once those three games are played, then you can make your judgment.
That's Jurgen Klinsmann, the head coach of the USA's World Cup team, and he was speaking from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Just hours before the World Cup's opening match between Brazil and Croatia in Sao Paulo, Brazilian police clashed with protesters. The buildup to Brazil 2014 has been marred by political unrest and construction delays. Police fired tear gas to disperse about 200 demonstrators angry about government overspending on the World Cup. The protesters were trying to cut off a key avenue leading to the Corinthians Arena, where the Brazil-Croatia match will be played. The demonstrators are upset that the government has spent billions of dollars on the World Cup at the expense of basic social services like education and housing. In more World Cup news, the indomitable Lions of Cameroon will be the first African team on the pitch in Brazil. Cameroon will meet Mexico Friday in Natal, Brazil. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma tells us more.
Cameroon's indomitable Lions, who are also in Group A, will be Africa's first team in action. My colleague James Batty spoke to Albert Njie Mbonde, a sports reporter with Cameroon Radio and Television, who gave an overview of the indomitable Lions team.
The team, it's a constellation of experience and young lads. I must say 15 out of the 23 have played at the World Cup at least once. And I think what has gone well with public opinion in Cameroon is that at least two local players have been selected, which is something like an improvement from what happened in 2010 when we took an all-professional squad to South Africa that failed to deliver and to perform. So a lot of people think that instead of taking all professionals who don't give the result, why not begin to introduce some local breeds? Just like we had in 1990, it was a sport that was constituted mainly by players from the local championship and who gave us the kind of results we have. And I think that two players taken from Cotton Sport of Garoua, that's a team that emerged third in the African Champions League last season, it's gone on well with public opinion, yeah, especially after the friendlies. The right back, Cedric Djegwe, performed really well, played without any complex, especially against the German national side in Mönchengladbach. I think public opinion holds that more and more there should be local players in the selection. And that we have a player like Samuel Eto'o who still has a last chance to perform, especially at the World Cup. A lot of comparison is being made between him and Roger Miller, who delivered a fine performance at 1990. Everybody holds that, okay, Eto'o has delivered for Cameroon, but a lot of his performances were registered at club. Now it's time for him to deliver for country. It may just be his last World Cup. And I think that's where the public is annoyed that the player should better concentrate on performing, and then money matters and other concerns could be raised after the World Cup.
That was Albert Njie Mbonde, a sports reporter with Cameroon Radio and Television, speaking in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Thanks, Mark. That's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Marco Uma. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon are making their African record 7th World Cup appearance, and they're hoping to bounce back from a dismal performance at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, where they lost all three of their matches before packing their bags after the group stage. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahyeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, a New York-based group providing services to cure birth defects in Africa. And next, criticism over the slow implementation of Zimbabwe's new constitution. But first, some music. Here is Fally Ipupa from the DRC with Ndoki.
Motos a la que yo ven a papá, le lo papá pongo a niña comita la tonto yo. Motos a la
mama lelo mama bomani ya komi vama tala petito yo mama mama président big master Parti parti par là, na place au tikangata nandela e. Batwa mawa bayi bata koyiba. Peut-être bakore vide motema oyo. O sale la ma beya koye koma kofime ye. Ona ba chok ya jamb na yo chéri. Noki ya vinangeza yo chéri. Mboti kangai na lela nangaye. Kama wakozonga Tukat na zampongi yebo kokoma Nazi sove mote sala kabaskaris peba mip Amune katinga mike mike Osa mwisi na loko la makila Netumba ya basa mora ya bepe Nenye tetrae kanga kalibumu Nendengo kokyo kanga balanga Meotiki nga ba pleur balame bebe
Ali Ipupa from the DRC with Ndoki.
Well, cleft lip and cleft palate are both defects that occur when a baby's lip or mouth do not form properly during pregnancy. They are easily repaired with surgery. Helping to provide treatment are the staff and medical volunteers with a group called AMREF Health. The New York-based group flies to remote areas of Africa to provide services for those with these conditions. Dr. Azret Mengisti is the head surgeon with the Clinical and Diagnostics Program of AMREF Health. VOA's Lenore Madu asked him if we know what causes these birth defects.
We don't know exactly what causes it in most cases, but it is believed that it is a combination of genetic factors and other environmental factors like consuming alcohol or lack of ingestion of folic acid during pregnancy and the like.
So how common is it in Africa where you work primarily?
We have done few research on that to know the exact incidence. It's more or less the same as in the rest of the world. Studies we did in Uganda and Ethiopia indicated that one child is born out of 700 live births in the region.
So I said earlier in my introduction that it is a minor surgery that can fix it. Tell us about that surgery. What is involved? How much time does it take? How challenging or not is it?
There is a time-tested methods of surgery, which are straightforward, not very complicated, and it takes on average like 1 hour to do a cleft lip surgery and another 1 hour to do a cleft palate surgery.
So what is the success rate?
In good hands, I can say, in terms of appearance, we get a success rate of satisfactory results in more than 95% of cases, whereas in terms of function, mainly in terms of speech, the results are much inferior, around maybe 70% of cases. We get a good appearance, but the speech function might not be to as we wish it to be.
Okay, and very quickly before we go, it seems to be a minor surgery. What do you see as the most challenging part of addressing this issue?
The most challenging part is that there are very few doctors who are able to repair this. For example, for an Eastern African countries where we're talking about a population of 200 million people, the number of plastic and reconstructive surgeons is not more than 30 in total. This is one. And whatever we do in surgery, we are better off. But the problem does not end with the surgery alone, because one can correct the cleft lip, cleft palate deformities, and appearance is improved. But we have challenges in terms of regaining function, okay, because we don't have enough specialists so that we handle the case in a holistic manner. For example, for a country of close to 80 million people in Ethiopia, we have only one speech therapist. And speech is a major problem in most cleft lip palate patients.
That was VOA reporter Lenore Madu. She was speaking with Dr. Asrat Mengisti of the group AMREF Health Africa.
In Zimbabwe, voters in a referendum last year approved a new constitution, but there is criticism over the way it's being implemented. Paul Mangwana is a former co-chairperson of the Constitutional Select Committee that crafted the document. He is critical about the lack of a body to monitor progress in enacting the constitution. Reporter Thomas Chiparisi has more details from Harare.
Addressing a conference on constitutionalism organized by the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, Mangwana said, unlike in Kenya, where a new constitution was adopted and fully implemented during the life of the unity government before elections were held in that country, Zimbabweans failed to set up a body that ensures that the constitution is adhered to, such as the one that was set up in Nairobi. Following the adoption of the new constitution by Zimbabweans last year through a referendum, President Robert Mugabe fast-tracked the holding of elections, with the two MDC formations that were in the unity government then calling for more time to allow for the realignment of laws to the new constitution to allow for the holding of credible elections. Mangwana told the conference that the absence of a body to monitor the implementation of the constitution has resulted in the country being exposed to the whim of the executive.
The mistake we made is not to have a committee which ensures that, or a commission which ensures that this constitution is implemented. We are at the mercy of the executive. We have to wait for them to do their work.
Mangwana's former colleague at COPAC, Douglas Mwonzora, who is also the spokesperson of the MDCT, agrees. He adds that what is lacking in the government is political will to democratize the country. Currently, there is no enabling legislation for the setting up of provincial councils, although they are recognized in the new constitution. Mwonzora says opposition legislators are also failing to sponsor private members' bills in parliament, saying it is expensive to do so.
For MDC members of parliament, or let me say non-ZANU-PF members of parliament, it's an academic exercise because members of parliament will have to vote in parliament. And unfortunately, ZANU-PF is dominating the parliament, and therefore the vote will go one way. What the people of Zimbabwe must do is to unite and force the executive to align the laws. Forget about the political differences that people have, but focus on the job at hand. So I would advocate a two-pronged approach. Having a body that deals with implementation, as well as the civil society and the society in general, demonstrating to make sure that these laws are put.
But Deputy Justice Minister Fortune Chasi, speaking at the same constitutional conference, said his ministry is aligning the laws, starting with those that are urgent, like the electoral bill, and urged Zimbabweans to be patient.
There are things that we can control as ministry. I can tell my drafters to say, I want the first draft tomorrow morning. They can work overnight. But I can't tell cabinet to sit. I'm a junior officer in the system. And I can't commandeer those ministers who sit in the legal committee. They want to be scrupulous.
They will take their time. Some of them are not lawyers.
The two MDC formations that were in the unity government tried in vain to postpone the holding of elections to pave way for the implementation of key reforms in line with the constitution. Civil society members who attended the conference called for a more proactive stance to push the government to institute the reforms. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Marty Curcius, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A disturbing pattern of arrests continues in Rwanda, where dozens of people have been detained by authorities for alleged state security offenses. Many were held without formal charges. The Rwandan government has been cited frequently for persecuting its opponents. Its reach has sometimes crossed borders. In March, South Africa expelled three Rwandan envoys it believes were linked to the killing of Rwanda's former chief of intelligence and an attack against Rwanda's former chief of defense staff. Both men had fallen out with the regime. Faced with an organized movement of anti-regime former government officials and a rebel movement operating in the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwandan government officials have defended their actions. They say they must take action against people they believe want to use violence against their people or the government. The United States is deeply concerned by the dozens of arrests that have taken place in the past 2 months. Some individuals were held for over a month without charge and were unable to communicate with lawyers or their families. The United States supports all lawful efforts to identify individuals who seek to use violence against the Rwandan people and government. But in a democratic society, individuals may not be arrested or detained without recourse to due process of law to certain minimum guarantees. That includes the right to challenge in a court the charges and witnesses against them. In a democratic society, all are equal before the law, prosecutors and the defendant. It is for a judge to determine guilt, not the government, no matter how well-intentioned it believes its motives. The United States calls on the Rwandan government to account for individuals arrested over the past 2 months in relation to these cases and currently in custody. It also must respect the rights under Rwandan law and international human rights law of individuals detained and arrested. We also call on authorities there to fully respect freedom of expression, including for members of the press, so that they may investigate, report, and facilitate discussion on issues of public concern.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Put your
flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet, and we'll bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
The Voice of America, VOA.